It gives me particular pleasure to introduce our speaker, who is Veljko Vujicic, who is an associate professor and chair of sociology from Oberlin College. And it's a pleasure not only because I'm a sociologist and so is Veljko, and it's always nice to have someone from one discipline come and visit us and give a talk, but also because I know Veljko going back a ways. Veljko received his PhD in sociology from University of California at Berkeley in 1995, and it turns out so did I. So Veljko and I actually know each other going back to graduate seminars, and I've learned a tremendous amount from my conversations with Veljko over the years from his particular perspective, and I know that you have in store a very interesting talk today. So Veljko's fields of specialization include sociological theory, political and comparative historical sociology, and social movements. He's focused particularly on post-communist society, communist and post-communist societies, in particular Yugoslavia and Russia. And he's published articles on these topics in sociological journals such as Theory and Society, Research in Political Sociology, and also Russian Area Studies journals, East European Area Studies journals such as the East European Constitutional Review, Post-Soviet Affairs, and the Harriman Review. He's published also in East European Politics and Societies. He's published in the publications that reach both an academic and non-academic audiences such as Telos. And he's currently completing a large comparative historical study of Russian and Serbian nationalism and the disintegration of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia. He's also working on a new project on charismatic and plebiscitary leadership in late communism and post-communism. The title of his talk today is Nationalism, Myth, and Politics, Russians and Serbs in the Dissolution of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia. And please join me in welcoming Professor Vujicic.
Thank you very much, Ted. It's a particular pleasure to be here at the University of Wisconsin and to see Ted advance to the position of director and hozyain and whatever else, not to say czar, of the Slavic scholarship at Wisconsin. A particular pleasure to be here. And yes, one of the elements in my short biography is I'm currently completing the manuscript, and I've been currently completing it for many years. So many years now that it's making me sick, but I'm now at the very, very end of that completion. And part of it, why it took so long, is the argument, and you'll see what it is. I want to begin perhaps somewhat stereotypically, but not redundantly, by a particular event of nationalist, that marked the beginning of nationalist mobilization in Serbia. And that was the night of April 24th, 1987, when the new president of League of Communists of Serbia, Slobodan Milošević, addressed a group of protesting Serbs in the small town of Kosovo Polje in the autonomous province of Kosovo. Kosovo Polje, by 1987, had become the center of a movement, an increasingly vocal movement of Kosovo Serbs dissatisfied with their status vis-a-vis the local Albanian majority. On several prior occasions, Serbian activists led processions of Kosovo Serbs to the National Assembly in Belgrade, seeking redress for their grievances from federal and Serbian party and government authorities, albeit with little success. While nominally a part of the Socialist Republic of Serbia, the Socialist Autonomous Province of Kosovo, following official titles, was de facto under the control of a predominantly, though not exclusively, Albanian political elite, which did little to prevent the immigration of an ever-declining number of Serbs from the region. What followed, nor was the federal state much more effective in halting this Serbian exodus from Kosovo during the 1980s, despite the routine incantations of party officials that the Albanian nationalist demand for an, quote, ethnically clean Kosovo was completely unacceptable to communists who would in any case uphold the Titoist principle of brotherhood and unity. Despite the heavy presence of army troops in Kosovo and the numerous arrests of Albanian irredentists, as they were called, officially the situation did not change. By 1987, the proportion of Serbs in the population of Kosovo declined to a little more than 10%, and it appeared that soon, or quite soon, no or very few Serbs would be left in the historical cradle of their state. The issue of Serbian immigration from Kosovo had assumed critical proportions. On that warm spring night of April 24, 1987, however, everything seemed to have changed, as the new leader of Serbia's communists suddenly turned from a dull gray apparatchik into a political hero. Standing on the balcony of the Kosovo Polje House of Culture, Milosevic observed the tumultuous crowd of Serbs who wanted to speak to the party leader of Serbia without the mediation of local Albanian or indeed Serbian officials, whom they saw as politically corrupt and bankrupt. When the local police began using truncheons to disperse them, the president of Serbia's communists, visibly shaken, walked towards the mass gathered in front of the building and suddenly pronounced a phrase which instantly turned him into a hero. "From now on, no one will dare beat you. No one has the right to beat you." What followed was a 13-hour-long meeting during which Milosevic patiently listened to the cahier de doléances of the Kosovo Serbs. Nothing like that had ever happened in the communist ancien regime. Politicians spoke in dull phrases about self-management and enemies of the party, or the latest and completely incomprehensible reorganization of the already tremendously complex Yugoslav political system. Even the word crisis, increasingly found in their speeches, could provoke only protracted yawns. Most importantly, they always spoke at, never with, or to the people. By contrast, the encounter of Serbia's party boss with the Kosovo Serbs was both direct and dramatic. Old men and women, grieving mothers and war veterans, came to the speaker's podium expressing anger and frustration at the impotence of Serbian and Yugoslav authorities who did nothing to protect the Serbian minority in Kosovo. Stories of arson, threats to life and property, and of mistreatment by the local party, judicial, and police authorities dominated the proceedings. At the same time, many of these not-so-sophisticated people were careful not to endorse anything that might appear as a politically unacceptable expression of Serbian nationalism and chauvinism, especially not in front of such a powerful official as the leader of Serbia's communists. Nevertheless, the boldness of their testimonies and speeches in what was still a very controlled communist regime suggested a level of desperation that turned into anger. As the meeting came to a close, Milosevic delivered a powerful speech in which he appealed to Serbs and Montenegrins, quote, "to stay here in Kosovo because this is your land, here are your houses, fields and gardens, your memories. You are not going to leave your land just because life has become difficult, because you're suffering from injustice and humiliation. It was never in the spirit of the Serbian and Montenegrin people to withdraw in the face of difficulties, to demobilize itself when it should fight, to become demoralized when the situation is hard. You should stay here both because of your ancestors and your heirs. Otherwise, your ancestors would be ashamed, your heirs disappointed." Milosevic ended his speech with an imperative statement in which he made clear to the Kosovo Serbs that, quote, "all of Yugoslavia is with you. It is not a question of Kosovo being a problem of Yugoslavia, but that Yugoslavia is also Kosovo. Yugoslavia does not exist without Kosovo. Yugoslavia disintegrates without Kosovo. Yugoslavia and Serbia will not give up Kosovo." Despite his repeated emphasis on Titoist ideals, brotherhood and unity, the Yugoslav idea, and on the need for the coexistence of Serbs, Montenegrins, and Albanians in Kosovo, Milosevic's speech was highly non-traditional for a communist. This was particularly true of that part of his speech in which he appealed to the traditional heroism of Serbs and Montenegrins in the face of injustice and humiliation and spoke of the significance of, quote, "land, memories, and ancestors." By linking the question of dignity in the face of injustice to a historical tradition of Serbian heroism, to land, memories, and ancestors, Milosevic was speaking in a new political language, the language of nationalism. Milosevic's Kosovo Polje speech almost instantly turned him into a hero of the masses. At a time when institutional gridlock was paralyzing the Yugoslav Federation and other communist leaders spoke in the frozen language of a half-dead ideology, Milosevic's direct appeal to the people over the heads of party officialdoms struck a powerful chord. Like Max Weber's prototypical charismatic leader, Milosevic appeared as a prophet endowed with a gift of grace, capable of delivering his people from suffering by performing the miracle of returning the Holy Land of Kosovo to the fold of Serbia. And in complete accordance with Weber's model, the personal devotion of his followers was based on a recognition of his charismatic qualities arising out of, quote from Max Weber, enthusiasm or of despair and hope. A year later, the Milosevic revolution, quote unquote, was in full swing. In summer 1988, masses of people came out on the streets to express their support for constitutional changes that would bring the two autonomous provinces, Kosovo and Vojvodina, under the control of Serbia. Although the regime played a considerable role in the organization of these rallies of solidarity, quote unquote, with the Kosovo Serbs, as they were called at the time, there was a distinct impression that the people had come out in the open, spontaneously expressing grievances and demands that had never been voiced before. The most striking aspect of these rallies was the peculiar mixture of traditional communist values, nationalist slogans, and celebrations of Milosevic's personality. At the same time, there was a dramatic revival of traditional Serbian cultural forms, from epic poems to folk music, from flags to peasant hats. As the Serbian poet Milovan Vitezović put it, enthusiastically a year later at one of the largest rallies of solidarity, what had transpired in Serbia was, quote-unquote, the people. Vitezović's enthusiasm aside, his diagnosis was correct. By 1989, a national populist movement with strong residual communist overtones and a culturally traditionalist ethos had emerged in Serbia, serving as the main source of legitimacy for a newly energized communist regime led by a potentially charismatic leader. A most unexpected concoction of communist and nationalist values, ideals, and organizational techniques was in the making, superimposed upon a traditionalist cultural repertoire of folk music and Serbian epics. By 1989, it became clear that similar processes were occurring in the Soviet Union, although peripheral nationalism, especially in the Baltic states and the Caucasus, seemed much stronger than the nationalism of the core nation, the Russians. This emergence of peripheral nationalism appeared to replicate processes which began taking place in Yugoslavia's more liberal environment already in the 1960s, when political and economic reforms precipitated a rapid decentralization of the state, leading to the accumulation of power in the hands of Republican Party and government elites, increasingly prone to seek political legitimacy by appealing to nationalist sentiments of their local constituencies. These Republican elites opened a political process which in some cases even then threatened the very existence of the Yugoslav state. By 1989, Gorbachev's sponsorship of popular fronts in the republics, popular fronts in support of perestroika on the territorial basis of Soviet republics, originally designed to undercut the power of the central party apparat, unintentionally produced a very similar dynamic in the Soviet case, giving powerful incentives to local elites to use nationalist appeals as a new source of legitimacy in a changing political environment. What had transpired in Yugoslavia over a period of some decades was happening in a collapsed way in the Soviet Union in a matter of few years. As the only two countries that implemented the system of ethno-territorial federalism, the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia shared important institutional features. The existence of Republican Party and government structures, cultural institutions such as academies of sciences and unions of writers, and the official encouragement given to local languages, despite linguistic russification in the Soviet case, led to the creation of ethnic, political, and cultural elites with a vested interest in the cause of the nation. The treatment of republics as the main units of central planning and the policy of the transfer of resources from more to less developed republics with the goal of equalizing economic levels was the feature of both cases, as was the ideological emphasis on brotherhood and unity, or Druzhba Narodov in the Soviet case, the friendship of peoples. All this gave an aggravating economic dimension to inter-republican relations, exacerbated conflicts among elites, and so on. And in the Soviet case, you had even formal preferential ethnic quotas in education, the internal passport system, and other features that didn't exist in Yugoslavia, which fortified nationalism. Under these conditions, in both countries, the commitment of ideology of party elites to internationalist aspects of communist ideology was one of the necessary preconditions for the survival not only of communist rule, but also of the larger state. That is why every period of political and economic liberalization, which led to the loosening of iron party discipline, gave greater scope to the initiative of local cadres and could become potentially threatening to the existence of the state. Given the fact that in the Soviet Union the legacy of communist nationality policy was much more traumatic than in the Soviet Union, just think of Stalin's deportations of peoples, genocides in Ukraine, Chechnya, Kazakhstan, wherever you have it, Given the traumatic historical legacy of purges, Russification policies, and deportations, one would have expected a much greater flare-up of violent conflict in the former Soviet Union than in Yugoslavia, and yet it didn't quite happen that way. And you would have expected a much stronger reaction on the part of the Russian elites, core elites, or pro-Soviet Russian elites, or Russian particularist nationalist elites, whatever elites, to the prospect of the disintegration of the state. And indeed, just like in Serbia, as of 1987-88, you see the beginnings of Russian conservative communists, Russia's conservative communists, appealing to nationalism or making loose coalitions with nationalist writers and various groups, sometimes with very chauvinist overtones, not only the notorious Pamyat, but others as well. So we saw an ideological transformation that seemed to point to a similarity between what Milosevic was doing in Serbia and what the Russian communists were beginning to do in Russia itself, at least so it seemed. Celebrations of Stalin on the pages of Maladaya Gvardia as a Russian national leader, calls for the creation of Russian institutions from the Academy of Sciences to a separate communist party, frequent congresses with nationalist writers and right-wing groups, and so on. The formation of Interfronti, that is, movements of ethnic Russians in the Baltics and other republics, all seem to point in the same direction. And yet, despite these institutional similarities, the outcomes were very, very different. Why were they so different? And in particular, what is astounding is the collapse of the Soviet Union, even more so than the Yugoslav path. What puzzled me when I initially began to study this was the weakness of the communist-nationalist coalition in the Soviet case, in the Russian case. Why was it that every time the party conservatives tried to do something or nationalist writers wrote a manifesto, they suffered a defeat? Why was it? Was there no patriotism in Russia? Was there no nationalism in Russia? Were there not legitimate nationalist grievances in Russia? Why was it that every time they did something, nothing happened? By contrast, Serbia was in the throes of nationalist mobilization. All right. So we have similar institutional makeups, analogous political processes, but very different outcomes, especially in terms of the degree of popular support enjoyed by communist nationalist coalitions in the two cases. All right. This is not to say, and just to make that clear, that in the Serbian case you also didn't have an opposition to this Milosevic movement. Of course you did, the emergence of alternative political parties, challenges from both liberal and nationalist points of view, and so on. I will not talk about them right now. But what is critical is that he succeeded in holding a coalition of party apparatchiks, federal army officers, former federal officials, state-dependent workers, elements of the intelligentsia, parts of the socialist middle class together, and ethnic Serbs from Croatia and Bosnia together for a significant amount of time, even if he went into decline eventually, whereas his Russian counterparts miserably failed. Witness the August coup, its almost comical character in 1991. Why was there so little support for saving the Soviet Union or creating a larger Russian national state that would incorporate ethnic Russians from the republics into an enlarged Russia, as Solzhenitsyn, for example, suggested? Let's leave the Soviet Union, but let's take parts of Ukraine and Kazakhstan inhabited by ethnic Russians, let them have referenda, let's create a real Russian national state, and so on. I was there in 1991 trying to do research on this problem of communism and nationalism when the Soviet Union collapsed. And how did it collapse? Three presidents met in some godforsaken place, Bielovezh, you never heard of it before, you heard it only after, and they signed away the Soviet Union. Okay? I mean, that borders on science fiction. If someone had told you 20 years ago, this is how the Soviet Union is going to collapse, some guys over a bottle of vodka, barely with faxes, okay, they had to fax their decision to turn the Soviet Union into a Commonwealth of Independent States, to Moscow, Kiev, and whatever, Minsk. Okay, if someone told you this is going to happen over a bottle of vodka and nobody will raise a voice, you would have told them, justifiably so, to go visit a psychiatrist, take some Valium, or question whether they were on drugs. Sure, the Soviet Union could collapse. People said it could. There would be a Muslim uprising. He'll end the career done cost. There would be communist neo-traditionalism and political corruption. Ken Jarrett. There were problems, but nobody expected it to happen in quite the same way. Let me just briefly address, I have to get to the substance of my answer, but let me briefly address whether the two cases are comparable. They are comparable because the relative size of the diasporas, that is the transborder populations, Serbs in Croatia and Bosnia, and Russians in Ukraine and Kazakhstan, to take the two critical cases, is comparable. In fact, the proportion of Russians in Ukraine is larger than the proportion of Serbs in Croatia. It was 22%, while in Croatia, Serbs were only 12.2%. In Kazakhstan, 38%. In Bosnia, Serbs, 31%. Moreover, these populations are comparable relative to the size of the majority group. In other words, what percentage of Serbs would be left out if Serbia had accepted the borders of Yugoslav republics as borders of states? About 23%, and when you add some self-proclaimed Yugoslavs, who were probably quite a few of them Serbs in Bosnia and Croatia, it would rise to 25%. In the Russian case, it's 17%, but if you add the Russian speakers, many of whom identify with Russia, that population swells by another 11 million people, making it certainly more than 20%. What kinds of arguments can be advanced to challenge this comparison? I actually examined alternative explanations in an article. I'll be happy to send it to you, but I'll just say a few words about a few of the critical ones. Size, that's what comes to mind right away. What is small Serbia compared to big Russia? How can you compare these two cases? Serbia can, you can put all of it in Moscow Oblast, right? While big Russia had nothing to lose, allegedly, by shedding its peripheries and much to gain in terms of economic advantage. And not only that, they made that argument. Many made that argument, Yeltsin himself and many others, that Russia would be better off without the republics. Okay, well, let me ask you a question. When did you see an example of empires or multinational states of the kind just freely giving away territories just because they were large? I mean, will we give up Texas or California if the demography changes? I mean, are we going to do it? When did you see territories collapsing or states collapsing because two leaders had a fight? You know, I love this explanation. Yeltsin didn't like Gorbachev, and Gorbachev didn't like Yeltsin, so Yeltsin decided to dissolve the Soviet Union. Really? Was it that simple? I mean, sure, there was a struggle for power, but why would one do that? Let's take another country, for example, France, which is, you know, not as big as Russia, but in world historical importance and the extent of its, you know, colonial possession certainly matches Russia. What did France do? Did it voluntarily give up Algeria? Didn't they try to shoot De Gaulle? How many times? Their charismatic hero from World War II. And here was Boris Yeltsin walking around triumphantly, and I was going to rallies in Moscow, rallies for the preservation of the Soviet Union in January, the first one in January 1992, 100,000 souls at most in Moscow, a city of 12 million people. My brother's party in Serbia could bring out 100,000 people occasionally on the square in a city 10 times fewer in size, a million, or five times smaller than Moscow. Where were all these people? Where were the millions of nomenklatura officials? Where were the army officers? Why didn't someone try to shoot Yeltsin? I mean, this is a guy who drank a bottle of vodka and decided to dissolve the Soviet Union. I mean, come on. Why didn't they try to get rid of him? What is this? How to explain? Moreover, even worse or more difficult question, how to explain the counterintuitive coalition between Yeltsin and Russian Democrats and peripheral nationalists against the Soviet state? So it's even more puzzling. All right. Nuclear weapons, that was another difference. Of course, when Yeltsin's press secretary in 1991, after the coup, said, well, Russia and Ukraine have to change borders, there was a storm of protest among Russian and Ukrainian intellectuals and political elites. Come on, we have nuclear weapons, you have to behave responsibly, don't provoke wars, and so on and so on. And indeed, that was a restraining factor, no doubt. Nevertheless, conceptually, I mean, why didn't Russian elites or even Russians on the periphery say, well, that's all right, we don't have to use nuclear weapons, we just want to have self-determination in Kuzbass, Donbass, wherever, northern Kazakhstan, let's take a vote. We can do it peacefully or at least autonomy. None of the sort. They voted for Ukrainian independence. Nothing of the sort. leadership. I'm not going to spend much time talking about it, just to say that I don't believe that you can reduce the appeals of Milosevic or Yeltsin just to instrumental considerations. There was a highly symbolic content to their appeals, and I'm going to illustrate that. And that is not surprising, because what we're talking about is nationalism, and nationalism is symbolic, not just instrumental. It's symbolic by definition because it's a fusion of politics and culture, unlike a movement for, let's say, trade union rights. All right, how can we begin to tackle this question? And as I said, I'm not going to talk much about alternative explanations. Or what is my answer, if there is one? I start with Max Weber's notion of the nation. I'm not going to talk about theory because I don't have time, and the empirical argument is much more interesting. But I'm just going to mention one idea. Weber says nation is a community of shared memories that is forged that is forged into a community of political destiny based on defining historical experiences. What I like about this definition is the historical experience part. He mentions the example of Alsatians in France who identified with France even though they were closer to Germans linguistically, culturally, ethnically, whatever way you want. Why? Because the Alsatians profited from the French Revolution, which abolished feudal privileges, which they turned, they deemed odious. So they were more loyal to France than Germany, and it is only just that they ended up there. How can you demonstrate what a defining historical experience is? Of course, you can't measure it with a ruler. You can't demonstrate it easily through quantitative analysis. How can you show that there's a decisive historical experience that has a hold on the national imagination over time, that what was relevant in the 20s is still relevant in the 1980s, and that it somehow influences political outcomes? Well, I'll try to make that case. I'm going to read you two quotes. The first one, I'm going to ask you to guess whom it's from, provided you didn't read my article. If you did, then just don't say anything. And yet the state itself, though accepted by the people as a necessary, fatal, and unavoidable principle, was ever regarded as something foreign, almost hostile to the human soul. Here we have touched the illogical, almost unexplainable psychological paradox of the Russian people. For centuries had the Russian carried on his shoulders the crushing burden of building a state. For centuries had he stubbornly advanced towards its predestined national boundaries, sacrificing whole generations and creating one of the greatest empires the world has ever known. And yet he had never felt the state was his own. He had always longed to exchange it for some stateless, perfectly free, and even anarchical form of communal life. There are those who will say that these anti-state longings of the Russian masses supply the proof of their extreme backwardness and barbarity. But hostile attitude to the state was not by any means a sign of cultural backwardness. It was to be observed even among the elite of Russian cultured society. The passive anarchism of Tolstoy, his teaching of not resisting evil, was no more than a final link in a long chain of anti-state sentiment which was current in Russian society. Who said this? No, someone earlier than that. But it's a good guess. But it's not even close. It's a good guess, though, because he said similar things. What do you think? Any other? Alexander Kerensky. I was flabbergasted myself when I read this. The Crucifixion of Liberty, 1934. Contrast this with the following quote from Serbia's greatest historian and one of its leading political figures, Slobodan Jovanović, whose life spanned almost 100 years of Serbian history and who wrote the authoritative account of 19th century Serbian history, participated in Serbian and Yugoslav state building, and also was the prime minister of the government in exile in 1941 in London. Summarizing the historical experience in an essay that was published posthumously in 1964, he had the following to say. The Serbs created their state after a long and bloody struggle against foreign powers. Consequently, among them, the state idea was connected to the national idea and became a synonym for national freedom. There are peoples among whom the state idea was equated with a dynastic tradition or a political ideology, or a specific state legal order, or even a certain level of material existence, maybe the American way of life, or, you know, Swedish social democracy.
material existence. These people, living in happier circumstances than the Serbs, did not have to see in the state the highest guarantor of their national freedom, for the sake of which one must be ready to bear the greatest sacrifices at any moment.
Okay, I'm not making a statement about national character. I don't think such a thing exists as a fixed entity, of course not in this day and age of social science. But I do think that the very different perceptions of the state, and they're not the only ones and are contested in both cases, did play a role in over time. Let me start with Serbia very briefly. One of the central things that, you know, people always talk about is the Kosovo myth and the Kosovo theme and so on, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it. But let me just say what I think about it. The central motif of the Kosovo myth, and, you know, Toma Loginovic is here, he will correct me if I'm wrong, as I understood it, in its modern, not old, religious interpretation, is heroic struggle against overwhelming odds. That is the message of the Kosovo myth. It is one of sacrifice against, in a situation in which potentially despair prevails. Let me try to read you a quote from Njegoš's Mountain. I'm not going to read the quote. Just what somebody said about it. Ralph Boger, a Slavic scholar, has observed that the idea of incessant struggle against overwhelming odds or incondition contains a mythic dimension that goes beyond concrete historical battles. It should be interpreted in terms of actual historical choices, choices that seem too symbolic, too mythopoetic to be as real as they really are. Choices like the one made by Tsar Lazar when he sacrificed his elite knights at Kosovo, like the one made by Bishop Danilo when he sacrificed his brothers who had converted to Islam, and like the choice made by General Živojin Mišić on the eve of the Battle of Suvor during World War I when he sacrificed an entire generation of young Serbian cadet officers on the front lines against the Austrian army. The idea of the Kosovo Pledge, Kosovski Zavet in Serbian, then consists in making the subjective choice, not only in full awareness of its tragic consequences, but also in the knowledge that the choice determines, quote Bogert, the mythical meaning of the battles as crucial moments in the national cultural legacy and is necessary for upholding ethnic, not necessarily epic, honor. Is that relevant for politics?
Yes, it is. In the darkest days of World War I, when Serbia is on its knees, its famous Prime Minister Nikola Pašić said that it is better for us to die like men than to live like slaves. Similar slogans were voiced by students in the population of Belgrade on March 27, 1941, in the wake of the army coup, which toppled the Yugoslav government that had signed a pact with Hitler. Better war than a pact, better grave than a slave.
Okay, pretty brave statement, to say the least, against Hitler, and of course, he took care of us in a matter of 12 days. Not bad, given the France lasted only 40.
What I'm arguing is that the Serbs not only transposed heroic self-sacrifice and myth of self-sacrifice, not only, let me rephrase it. Serbs, as Jovanović said, achieved their state, and as these statements illustrate, not demonstrate, achieved the national state at great cost for the nation in human terms, and more importantly, transposed some of the strong feelings from Serbia onto the Yugoslav state in the interwar period. In fact, Yugoslavia became their preferred object of identification rather than Serbia. How do I know that that is true? Well, of course I don't, indisputably, but as a historical sociologist, I choose a critical moment. A critical moment is 1939. In 1939, the previously Yugoslav unitary state is transformed into a de facto federal one, the Serb-Croat Agreement. It basically creates a large Croatian federal or pseudo-federal unit within Yugoslavia, and it forces Serbs to reflect on who they are and what this all means. Members of the Serbian Cultural Club, among them Jovanović, and some great historians like Vladimir Čorović, who wrote a history of Bosnia as well as Yugoslavia and Serbia and so on, begin to write about the meaning of the Serbian historical experience at this defining moment. One editorial makes it explicit. I don't have time for everything. He says, while the contributions of other Yugoslav nations to the creation of Yugoslavia were beyond doubt,
It is an indisputable fact that the Serbs bore the greatest sacrifices and have given most for it, Yugoslavia. What makes them different from others is the devoted participation of all popular strata in the creation of the state, not just intellectuals. All his Serb sacrifices were made for Yugoslavia, and he will not refrain from them today if the interests of Yugoslavia so demand. This is on the eve of World War II. For this reason, whoever sins against Serbdom could be forgiven, but one who sins against the state is our mortal enemy, with whom we engage in open combat. Likewise, Slobodan Drašković, another prominent intellectual, emphasized, quote, that all Serbs from the first to the last will fight for Yugoslavia today, just as they had for Serbia in 1912, 13, 14, 18. Everyone knows this well, Serbs and Croats, Slovenes, minorities and foreigners, friendly or unfriendly, and so on. Well, maybe that was the case in interwar Yugoslavia. Didn't the communists change all this? I mean, after all, didn't the communists promise an end to greater Serbian hegemony? Didn't they devolve the state, decentralize it? Didn't they do away with the Serbian monarchy? Didn't they decapitate Serbia's political parties? Didn't they essentially spit on Serbian national traditions, Orthodox Christianity, and whatever else you have? Yes, to a certain extent, all that is true. They did. They severed the institutional link between Yugoslavia and Serbia, between Prussia and Germany, okay, by giving Bavaria more power. And so Saxony, Rhineland, and everyone else. True enough. But if you look at World War II, it is often said, and I've read a lot up on it, it is often said that Tito's army was a multi-ethnic army, and that is why it succeeded. That is true, undoubtedly, because without the Croatians, for example, in the rank of partisans, there could not have been a second Yugoslavia, no doubt. Nevertheless, when you look at the figures, especially in the first 2 years of the war, you will see overwhelming Serb participation, especially Serbs from Croatia and Bosnia. Much of this was accidental. Peasants who fled from the independent state of Croatia and massacres fled into partisan Tito's partisan units. As late as the end of 1943, when the partisan movement made significant inroads among non-Serbs, 15 out of 27 partisan divisions appear to have been made up of Serbs, primarily those from Croatia and Bosnia. About 60% of the national heroes of Yugoslavia officially proclaimed were Serbs, 40-some percent of the population, 60%. More importantly than that, you see the same symbolic appeals on the part of communists to Serbian/Yugoslav traditions as you see before. That is what is the most fascinating and interesting. I have many, many examples. I'll just read you one. By Milovan Djilas, a Montenegrin communist whom you all know because he was a dissident. Later on, Yugoslav Trotsky. And when he went to mobilize the Serbian peasants and talk to them in Kordun, which is Croatia, and talk to them about class struggle, they looked, of course, as peasants would look, as anyone talking about dialectical materialism. It would be just the same as the Appalachian hillbillies would look to us if we started advocating transgender bathrooms. They didn't understand what was going on. Milan Gilas then changed his rhetoric and said the following. I, too, was involved in the misfortune of these peasants as a participant, so I addressed these peasants in the language and values of their heritage, knowing that this could best console them. How do you think that the Serbs can ever free themselves except by death and sacrifice? When did a Serb ever free himself in any other way? Remember Kosovo. This is a communist speaking, okay? The heroes of Kosovo also chose death in order to preserve the Serbian name. Do you remember the saying, he curses like a Serb on a stake? And would Karadzic have freed Serbia had he not hurled it into blood and fire? And as for Montenegro, who would have ever heard of it had it not shed its blood for centuries? And would there ever have been a Yugoslavia without Serbia's victories and sufferings in the last war? I don't claim that I said these very words, but I didn't afford that I didn't go at greater length, but it's very telling. In other words, what I'm arguing is that there was an institution, that there was a political, cultural, not institutional autonomy, not institutional continuity, excuse me, in Serbian attachment to the Yugoslav state, and that carried on to the very end. I don't have time to demonstrate that, but I'll be happy to do it in questions and answers. What I'm basically saying is the following. Everything's dropping. Okay. I'm too excited. What I'm basically saying is the following. If you read Milosevic's speeches and symbolic appeals, they are as much, if not more, and often quite more, about
the parties and legacy, the Yugoslav revolution, the Yugoslav state idea as they are about Serbia. And that it is not an accident that Serbian nationalists, properly speaking, particularists, anti-communist nationalists, Vuk Drašković and others, lost the elections, not just because it was manipulated in 1990, there was that, but because many Serbs, despite what they say today, identified positively with communism, not as an ideology, but as a movement that has recreated the Yugoslav state. That's key. So when the Slovenes and Croats and others said, we want to leave, this was interpreted as treason, okay? In Russia, quite the opposite. Let me just run through it very, very quickly. I'm pressed for time. First, let me just point out that a significant current of Russian public opinion came to view the Soviet state in a fashion that was almost diametrically opposed to the one that we witnessed in Serbia and Yugoslavia. The idea that the state is an oppressive force in Russian national life, of course, is a very old one and goes back at least to Peter the Great, but it was in the 19th century age of nationalism when it was interpreted as such. In Konstantin Aksakov's famous memorandum to Alexander II, there was a contrast drawn between the state and the land. According to Aksakov, it was Peter the Great who tore asunder the ancient union of the land and the state and replaced it by a domination of the state over the land. That is, in which the land of Russia, listen to this, as it were, became a conquered territory and the state became its conqueror. That is how the Russian monarch was transformed into a despot and his willing subjects into slaves held captive in their own country. Aksakov, of course, was a Slavophile, but he passed on this perception together with hints into the Russian populists, the Narodniki, and later on to Lenin, who exhibited an almost pathological hatred for the autocracy and the state. To be sure, there were political forces in Russian history that were pro-state. The Zemstvo movement, liberalism, Boris Chicherin, and many others. Details are unimportant at this point. But the main point is that the autocracy's persistent refusal to place itself on the foundation of the nation to transform itself into a representative state resulted in the growth of alienation, not just among communists and social democrats, but also sometimes even among right-wingers and liberals. Paul Milyukov, for example, Pavel Milyukov, he says, the sympathies of a foreign public may indeed have been chilled by what was considered a conspicuous lack of patriotism in my countrymen by Tolstoy's letter on the Russo-Japanese War, but in all justice to us, it must be borne in mind that out of necessity or love of country sometimes assumes unexpected forms. We draw a big contrast between the official patriotism of Pleve, the Minister of Interior, and the patriotism of Tolstoy, and we know which patriotism is genuine, that of Tolstoy, and which patriotism is false, that of Tsarist officialdom. The Russian Revolution is often, most often, analyzed only as a social revolution. However, it was also a national revolution in the following sense. It eliminated the Tsarist bureaucracy and autocracy. It eliminated the westernized landlord once and for all. And at least during Lenin's NEP, New Economic Policy 21-28-9, it was supposed to be theoretically, conceptually, a Russia for the Narod, for the workers and peasants. Of course, they persecuted the intelligentsia, no doubt. But what is significant is that even many members of the intelligentsia, from the peasant poets, like Pilnyak to others, to the Smenarikovtsi, whatever, expected that Russia would become a national state, finally. A characteristic example was, most prominent was Nikolai Uzbel, the national Bolshevik, who said, Russia is red from the outside and white from the inside, it's like a radish. And when you peel off the communist red, you'll get the Russian white. The communists restored the Russian Empire, that's just fantastic, and we'll wait for our moment to take over from the communists and turn it into a Russian nationalist state or empire or whatever you have. Well, too bad, Comrade Ustryalov, Stalin killed you in 1936. Stalin's forcible collectivization, drive against the peasantry, which was the main historical symbol of the Russian people and nation, restored the image of the overbearing, oppressive state. In the words of Robert Tucker, whom I love, but whom few read nowadays in the age of historical revisionism, the outstanding single manifestation of the totalitarianizing process was the terroristic collectivization of the peasantry and the reimposition of serfdom within the framework of the Kolkhoz. Here, the state acted quite literally the role of the conqueror of rural Russia. And according to him, the main consequence of this process was the revival of the old image of dual Russia, the contrast between the almighty state and the innocent, victimized people of Russia on the level of social perception. He's writing this in the early 70s, but referring to his experience of the 40s and 50s high Stalinism and early post-Stalinism. Subsequent historical research has confirmed the validity of this idea. Among the peasantry, the onset of collectivization quickly led to an old-stale nativist reaction that identified the alien state as the main victimizer of the people. The state was seen by many as an antichrist in Lynn Biola's book. The similarity was drawn in the peasant mind between old serfdom and the new Kolkhoz. And the new serfdom was seen as even more onerous in view of what transpired in the 20s, that is, the promise of the great repartition of the land in favor of the peasantry. Also, by the 1930s, one historian writes, the image of dual Russia was no longer limited to the peasantry, but became generalized in popular discourse. In this dichotomous vision of society, divided into us and them, us stood for the workers, people, those on bottom, peasants, Russians, masses, and them stood for those on top, responsible workers, party members, the state, the rulers, the new bourgeoisie, the new capitalists, engineers, and technical workers, Jews, and less commonly, rotten intelligentsia, academics, and tzadki, little tsars. Informally, many among the Narod made no distinction between the Tsarist and Soviet states, seeing the rulers of both of them as equally disingenuous and deceptive. You know, it's popular to say that Stalin had a social base these days. That did not occur in a vacuum. Of course, Stalin promoted people through social mobility. But there's an astounding statistic I came across. In 1939, Hitler's Gestapo had 7,000 full-time officials. The NKVD and the Soviet apparatus of coercion had 400,000. 7,000 versus, who had more popular support? 400,000, 26 more times per capita than in the Nazi case. That means a lot of coercion was required to subdue the social base of Stalinism. Can we prove or show or demonstrate that this perception indeed mattered? Yes, it did. It mattered the most, and it reemerged with a vengeance after World War II. On the surface of it, World War II, the Second Patriotic War, the Great Patriotic War, was a period of time when Stalin appealed to Russian national sentiment, especially during the first 2 years of the war, and allegedly broke this link, or if you want, broke this symbolic perception, at least for a time. Well, to an extent. There were two kinds of patriotism that emerged in World War II. One was the official patriotism promulgated by Stalin and his comrades, increasingly after 1943 co-opted for the state, and the other one was what historians have called the more articulate and individualistic patriotism, in which Stalinist ideology gave way to the heroic feats of individuals, the patriotism of citizens, in the words of Jeffrey Brooks, with an active sense of themselves and their wishes. A powerful expression to these awakened civic feelings during the first years of the war was given by Ilya Ehrenburg, the sympathizer of the Bolsheviks and the key propagandist of the anti-Nazi effort. And here's what he says, a very moving and puzzling statement. The Germans hoped to provoke a civil war in Russia, but all distinctions between Bolsheviks and non-party people, between believers and Marxists, have been obliterated. Some defend time, others space, but time and space, this is the motherland, this is the earth, this is such and such a height, such and such a line, such and such an inhabited place. They pray for the Red Army in old churches. Wow. The domes of which have not been darkened so that they would not attract German pilots. Muftis and rabbis pray for the Red Army. Millions of people have just started to be alive. These days of trial were their first books, their first theater, their first happiness. They will give up everything, if not only to be German slaves. wait a second, why do you need a world war and Nazi onslaught to start feeling alive? Didn't you feel alive before that, comrades? No. Why not? The meaning of relief that Ehrenburg implies, that is, in Ehrenburg's sentence, we detect the idea, something of a sigh of relief. The meaning of relief was explained by one of the characters in Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago, who explained that, quote, when the war broke out, my God, phone, that's terrible. Sorry. Always haunts us, doesn't it? Okay. Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago, who explained that when the war broke out, its real horrors, its real dangers, its menace of a real death were a blessing compared to the inhuman power of the lie. A relief because it broke the spell of the dead letter, the dead letter being Stalinist ideology. Please take it out, kill it, throw it away. Not only journalists, poets, and composers, but many ordinary Russians remember the first 2 years of the war as a time of relative freedom, collective solidarity, civic participation, and spontaneous de-Stalinization. And this kind of patriotism obviously bothered Stalin and his followers, and as of 1943, he took it away from them. He created the new Soviet anthem. He started already then preparing the grounds for the post-war anti-cosmopolitan campaign in Stanovchina. The critical period when this perception of dual Russia was resurrected, and which had an impact during Perestroika as well on the thinking of many, from Alexander Yakovlev, the architect of Perestroika, to Valentin Rasputin, the peasant prose writer, from Democrats and Westernizers to Russian nativists and nationalists. The key period when this perception crystallized was Khrushchev's thought. One wants to destroy technology sometimes. That's why I don't have a PowerPoint, because no one will listen. Khrushchev's thought. The three most important books, really, if you think about it, or authors, Pasternak, Solzhenitsyn, and Vasily Grossman, who brought this perception forward, all started or finished their books during the thaw. Dr. Zhivago, Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate, and Solzhenitsyn, of course, both in Matryona's Home and his stories, and Ivan Denisovich, of course, compellingly in the Gulag Archipelago. The war in Grossman's, in particularly in Grossman's Life and Fate, the war figures prominently as a period when freedom reigned. In the great novel Life and Fate, which is devoted to the Battle of Stalingrad, all right, I'm trying to find something among my many papers. The main character is Viktor Shtrum, who is a scientist, partially autobiographical character. Grossman demolishes the myth of the great patriotic war. Perhaps the sole historic achievement that a Soviet Russian citizen was justifiably proud of. The main point of his novel is that the struggle against the Germans is a secondary theme in Life and Fate, while its main leitmotif is the struggle of ordinary Russians as individuals for freedom and against their own state, which claims their victory for itself. In this remorseless cunning of history, Grossman says, we see the true meaning of Stalingrad. Quote, freedom engendered the Russian victory. Freedom was the apparent aim of the war, but the sly fingers of history changed this freedom, became simply a way for waging the war, a means to an end. Viktor Shtrum, the character who discovers this truth, who is a physicist of Jewish origin and indispensable because his discoveries will give Stalin the nuclear bomb, presumably discovers the omnipotent state and fears it. Its image haunts him like an evil ghost. Victor felt a shiver of fear, the fear that was always lurking in his heart, fear of the state's anger, fear of being a victim of this anger that could crush a man and grind him to dust. Shtrum is in awe of power of a state that raises a man up, then throws him effortlessly into the abyss. He could feel tangibly the difference in weight between the fragile human body and the colossus of the state, and so on throughout the novel. You don't have to be, a nuclear physicist to understand it. Just watch the not-so-great, but still good movie, Enemy at the Gates. It's especially great for undergraduates. There you have heroic snipers fighting their way through the rubble of Stalingrad, two snipers, German and one, and you have the party state coming in the form of a commissar who tries to boss around the sniper, who couldn't care less because he's going to die. So what Comrade Stalin says doesn't really matter if you're going to die in the rubble of Stalingrad. Therefore, you might as well be free and say whatever you want. You see, that's what he means. And do whatever you want. Was this relevant in the perestroika period? Yes, it was. Alexander Yakovlev, I'm just going to talk spontaneously now a little bit and finish. Alexander Yakovlev said that the defining experience of his life was the post-war period. Because Stalin deported millions of prisoners of Nazi camps into Siberia because they were too Western. They were Westernized, imagine, in German camps. So they represented an ideological threat. Alexander Solzhenitsyn says the same thing in the Gulag Archipelago. The Russian peasant poet writer Vladimir Solovkin, by no means a liberal, says something to the effect that how come in all of Russia's history there were no traitors? In all the wars she waged, there were no traitors from Peter the Great onwards, but suddenly, in 1945, there are millions of traitors. How come is this possible? In other words, what I'm trying to say to you, that the image of Russia as and Russians as a colonized people, colonized by their home state, became pervasive during Khrushchev's stall in the most important writings, and again reflected in the discourse of perestroika in the left, center, and right. I can give you numerous quotes from party programs of democratic parties to the memoirs of Anatoly Sobchak, whomever you want, it's all covered, to Solzhenitsyn, across the political spectrum. The last quote I'm going to read is from, if I can find it in my papers, from Boris Yeltsin himself, the new good Tsar, who lasted shortly, but did leave some impact. It's here, at the end of this article. When he was inaugurated the first freely elected president of Russia in June 1991, Yeltsin said the following thing. And Boris Yeltsin, we know, was not a highly intellectual person. He was a member of the Narod, and he embodied it both in his stature, energy, frightful force, and drinking. Yeltsin felt compelled to say the following. Words cannot convey the feelings I'm experiencing at this minute. For the first time in the 1,000-year history of Russia, he's not talking about the Soviet Union, a president is being solemnly sworn before his fellow citizens. For centuries in our country, power and people have been at opposite poles. For centuries, the interests of the state have, as a rule, been put above those of the individual, his needs and aspirations. We have regrettably come later than other civilized people to realize that the state's strength lies in the well-being of its citizens. Negation of this sacred principle laid to ruin the greatest empires of the past. We have had to pay a colossal, unprecedented price for our experience. No doubt Yeltsin's dissolution, move to dissolve the Soviet Union had much to do with the Ukrainian referendum. He didn't personally want it necessarily. He certainly wanted to have some form of union or confederation. What is telling is that in his own memoirs, the discussion of the failed coup is followed by the story of his father's forcible equal accusation, while the decision to dismantle the Soviet Union in December 91 is accompanied by the statement that in signing this agreement, Russia was choosing a different path, a path of internal development rather than an imperial one. That is, what I'm trying to say is, you understand, clear now. Yugoslavia was perceived as a nation state by the Serbs, while in Russia, the Soviet party state was not perceived, correctly not perceived, as a Russian nation state. What kind of nation state is that in which you cannot read your favorite poets because they're censored, because they're anti-Soviet? What would you feel about the United States of America if somebody banned Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls as a communist novel while letting you read A Farewell to Arms because it's just about World War I? Is that a state that embodies a national culture? Of course not. So I'll end with a joke, just to make you laugh after this whole heavy story, that really embodies my argument. It's a Serbian joke and a Russian joke. A Serbian joke goes like this. Two Serbian soldiers conquer a hill, and one puts a flag and says, "This is Serbia." And the other one takes a gun and shoots the first one and said, "No, Serbia is wherever there are Serbian graves." The Russian joke goes like this. Two moles are talking, father and son, moles, you know? And the little mole says, Daddy, Daddy, I have a question for you. You know, I'm looking through a little hole under the ground, and I see something beautiful, you know, endless, and, you know, blue and gray and light and dark, and what is that? That's the beautiful sky. It surrounds the whole earth, you know. Daddy, another question. In this beautiful sky, I sometimes see something yellow and orange and shiny and so warm that it penetrates even our little hole underground. It, you know, gives so much light. What is that? That's the sun, my son. It gives life to everything through photosynthesis and whatever else, you know. And Daddy, you know, sometimes I dare peek my little thing, you know, through the hole and above, and I see something green, and it's all around, and it's everywhere, and it smells wonderful. What is that? That is the beautiful green grass, my son. It's everywhere. It gives life to everything. Daddy, I just have one last question. Forgive me for being such an egg. You know, when it's so nice up there, what are we doing underground? He says, we're staying here because we love our socialist fatherland. Потому что мы любим наше социалистическое отечество. Okay, or социалистическую родину, whatever. Alright, so that embodies that large-scale difference. Now, I'm not saying other factors, you know, Milosevic, Yeltsin, institutional, political processes didn't matter. But what I'm arguing is if you don't take this interpretive, if you want, difference seriously, if you don't take this difference in political cultural experiences seriously, you won't have a really adequate causal explanation of why the dissolution went so differently in the two cases. That's what I'm arguing. I'm not arguing the other causal factors are not important. Because, forgive me, Yoshiko, I'm not a political scientist, so I don't have to say that I have only one variable and six cases. I can have six variables and two cases. That's good for me. All right, thank you.
We still have time for some questions. So please, questions, comments for Professor Nietzsche.
When I was traveling in former Yugoslavia in the 80s and talking to Serbs, urban Serbs, they often expressed frustration that the state was frustrating Serbs, that they had, you know, the subtext was they had earned being the boss because of the experiences that you adduced. And they felt that which is a little bit contrary to what you were saying in relation to their attitude toward the state. How do you contextualize that for me?
Of course, absolutely, you're right. I mean, after all, you know, they didn't save Yugoslavia, they started creating Greater Serbia, they started engaging in ethnic cleansing and doing all kinds of horrible things. Absolutely correct. So what I'm documenting in the second part of the book is this rise of Serbian particularism, exactly the perception you described, that somehow the Tito's communists, you know, dismembered Serbia, somehow the Serbs were not occupying the rightful place in the state that they had earned. Not necessarily to be bosses, but that, you know, they had to be recognized as a core nation and so on. All this is, and there was a tremendous amount of ressentiment caused by the discrepancy between what Serbs thought they deserved to have in terms of power and what they actually had in the second Yugoslavia. So there was a rise of Serbian particularism, and of course, without that, there would not have been, if it wasn't so vigorous and strong, there wouldn't have been disintegration. But what I'm trying to say, and you're absolutely right, so there was Serbian nationalism of a different kind, but what I'm trying to say is the following. It is ambivalent. It is certainly ambivalent in many ways. Why did Milosevic, for example, have to call his country the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia? Is it just because he wanted to have Serbian Montenegro? Is it just because he wanted to have continuity with state institutions and collect the embassies abroad and the personnel and grab the resources? Why did Milosevic go to General Ratko Mladic in what is a known episode in Bosnia and said to him, what kind of hat are you wearing? Ratko Mladic has changed from a communist Yugoslav cap to a Serbian hat. Okay, that was the Serbianization of the Yugoslav army. Okay, and he said, where is your red star, Comrade Mladic? Okay. The pure Serbian particularist, of course, it became much stronger among Serbs in Croatia and Bosnia for understandable reasons. Both Milosevic pushed them in that direction, Tudjman was perceived as a threat, and, you know, I did not even talk about, you know, World War II and the massacres, and somebody was perceived as a horrible symbolically. Maybe not in reality, maybe he wasn't, but symbolically it was a disaster. When, for example, Tudjman said, of course, his famous sentence, that the independent state of Croatia was not just a fascist creation, but the product of historical circumstances and reflected the historical aspirations of the Croatian people for independence. That would be like someone saying the southern United States was not just a slave state, but also a reflection of the historical aspirations of Texans and, you know, Georgians, not those, these, for state rights, okay? So there were symbolic moments and political processes that, you know, Serbianized and resulted in a growth in Serbian particularism. You're absolutely right. But this residual, very strong Yugoslav component was also present. For me, the telling sign is that pure Serbian particularists lost elections. The most free and fair ones in the beginning, then later there was doctored. But, you know, the people who tried to rehabilitate Mihailovic and the Chetniks in World War II basically lost out. You know, that's the puzzling thing, right? If the Serbs were such great Serbian nationalists, you know, why did they work for this communist all the time? I mean, there must have been a very strong constituency there for whom this partisan experience was transformative. And that corresponds to my kind of anecdotal experience, especially with older people. You know, this is like World War II. We're fighting the Ustashi in Croatia, okay? I mean, they were reliving their experience, but not from a Chetnik point of view so much, though it became confused over time, but from a more kind of partisan point of view. And I think a lot of the Serbian particularism and disappointment and resentment that was so visible was caused by the perception that the Slovenes first and then the Croats were betraying Yugoslavia, okay? Betraying the state. That's how I would answer it, but of course, you're right. Yes.
Yeah, it's a very interesting talk. I guess you probably get this question all the time, but I have to ask it anyways. About the current resurgence of Russian nationalism and how you think it fits. And I guess two things that stick out to me is, on the one hand, I find the story very plausible about this disjuncture between the state and people or individuals during the Soviet period. But on the other hand, the complexity is also that a lot of Russians are extremely proud of some of the scientific and military achievements of the Soviet Union under Stalin. So there's a kind of complexity there that people even today, they are nostalgic for the great power status, Russia's place in the world. They think of Russia as having a sort of place in the world. So there's a certain, I think, widespread understanding of achievements that happened also under the Soviet state. And now you have Putin together with a kind of resurgent nationalism. Putin also represents a strengthening of the state over the weakening under Yeltsin. So I guess
it's absolutely correct. Yeah, is that your question, Max? Yeah, I mean, I get this question a lot, and I have an answer to it. Maybe it's not convincing, but I have an answer. First, this ends in 1991. Post-91, it's no longer the Soviet Union, it's Russia, okay? So by definition, it's going to be a nationalizing state, to quote Rogers Brubaker, even by default, because everyone else is nationalizing. So what else is there? There's no more communism, liberalism failed in the early 1990s. So what do we expect Putin to be? You know, I mean, Putin may not have to be an autocrat, that's a different question. But some form of nationalism was to be expected, and nationalization of the state. Secondly, of course, anti-statism was not the only current in Russian history. Statism, imperialism had its followers and had them during perestroika, and indeed, they were the ones who organized the August coup or tried to support it or whatever. That's absolutely correct. I think that what is happening under Putin, and I'm not a specialist of the Putin era, I haven't studied it closely, there are several things that are happening. First, unlike in Eastern Europe, you know, where your grandma can still tell you what waiters looked like in a Belgrade restaurant in 1933 and what it was to dance a waltz and what political parties were like, so Russians have no memory of Tsarist Russia. So therefore, all this talk about, you know, you know, Euro-Asianism and Slavophilism, I mean, and God knows what. I mean, there's an overproduction of ideology at the expense of the material base, to use a Marxist metaphor. And so many versions of the Russian idea that no one can understand them anymore. And what is much more powerful than ideology is a concrete experience. And there's only really one concrete experience that you can really, not one, several, but one overwhelmingly positive about. That's World War II. Because no, yes, it was Stalin, but it was us who won the war, right? That's it. And so, and of course, Gagarin is neutral because who could have anything against sending a man into space for the first time? Okay, nuclear power is good because, you know, Russia was attacked so many times in its history, so it's good to know that you can never be attacked again. And as Putin said himself in one of his lucid moments, of which there are many, but there are also many unlucid ones. If we agree that the symbols of the preceding epochs, including the Soviet epoch, must not be used at all, we will have to admit that our mothers' and fathers' lives were useless and meaningless, that their lives were in vain. Neither in my head nor in my heart can I agree with this. So, in other words, you have to create some kind of positive identity for Russians. You cannot just say everything was terrible. Collectivization, the purges, the deportation of prisoners, they all said that in the 1980s, right? In the late 1980s, that was all over, Novy Mir, wherever, in the newspapers. And I finally have to search for something positive, and the only positive thing that can be there, really, is this World War II, and that's why it's such a cop. Now, is that a real nationalism, or is he building a Russian nation state? In my mind, no. Why? I think Putin's nationalism is another version of official nationalism. It's Nicholas II and Stalin again in a different form. Why? Because it's all symbolic, it's non-representative, there's no way that society can translate their spontaneous national patriotic feelings into state policy, influence state policy. Everything is again decided, you know, by Putin, Medvedev, and three others, or 75 others, it doesn't matter, but it's not millions of others. So it's not a civic nationalism in the sense that it gives the nation representation. The third estate is unrepresented still. And it's not ethnic because Russia is not an ethnic state in that it's a nationalizing state, but it can never be a pure ethnic state. And witness what he's doing to civic and ethnic nationalists. Garry Kasparov and Edward Limonov are being arrested. Two guys raise their heads, one a former world championship, the other a lunatic writer. One says, I'm for a Russia that has some freedoms and representation. The other says, I want us to be a fascist state. Again, together they march against Putin and he arrests them, okay? So he persecutes really all forms of independent national feeling and tries to incorporate it, co-opt it, symbolically ritualize it, Yedinstvo, Nashi, God knows what, okay, official ceremonies, comment Stalin, yes, a little bit, but not too much. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, yes, let's go to his funerals, but not too much. I mean, he's trying to purge this experience, which is fundamentally ambivalent, World War II, purge it of its ambivalence and create it into a positive experience. The older people remember that Stalin screwed up in 1941. The older people remember that millions were captured prisoner. The older people remember, okay, that millions were deported. The older people remember, etc. That the point, that the hopes that freedom will come after World War II would be disappointed. Okay, so even if you watch Russian cinema in the thaw period, the cranes are flying or wings by Shupitkov, okay, you see this tremendous nostalgia for World War II. It's in Shepitko's wings she wants to fly again because that's the only place where she feels free as a pilot in World War II. Okay? So it's an official nationalism. Sure, there had to be some state building after, you know, governors started negotiating borders with China on their own. I mean, who's going to tolerate these feudal barons of Russia? After a while, somebody had to put a stop to that, and people will...